Good morning.
All right, so today we're going to switch gears a little bit, and we're going to start looking at the graphics pipeline and kind of how the GPU has evolved from something that was completely fixed function, just made to accelerate rendering, to something that's general purpose that we've seen earlier this semester. So next Monday is a pretty big day, I think, for this class. So as you guys know, homework 3 is due. Hopefully everyone has logged in and gotten started. We're also going to kick off the project then too, which nothing is due for your project at that point, but we'll spend probably a third of the class period talking about what the expectations are, and I have a number of project ideas that I'll pitch for you guys. So then we'll really start rolling on that after spring break. And then we'll also have to start student presentations too, which I think is a really exciting part of this course. So next Monday is a big day. As I said last time, we've come pretty far away in this class, right, where we looked at GPU architecture, and then we looked at efficiently programming that with CUDA, then we looked at a number of parallel algorithms. And now we're going to switch into graphics. We're still a combination of the GPU compute stuff done by the student presentations. And like I said, this is the opposite of what we've done historically in this class, which is where we taught graphics first and then added the GPU compute on the end, which is how the pipeline evolved, although I think this is going to turn out to be a better way to teach it, but I definitely want to hear what you guys think about that. So before I jump into all the graphics stuff, I just kind of want to gauge, you know, what you guys already know, and I recognize that not necessarily everyone has taken 460 or 560, and even though that's the official prereq, I'm completely okay with that. I welcome everyone in this class, and I know there's different people have different interests and different backgrounds, and that's why they want to learn about using the GPU. So today, this is kind of like a combination of kind of review some of the stuff that you've probably seen in 460, or if it's new to you, hopefully it's enough for you to be able to do some programming, which assignment 4 will be writing shaders to do some graphic stuff. But let's say, sure, here we go. Right. So I'm interested in graphics, and say I define some world coordinate system. And is everyone comfortable if you see like a 3D Cartesian coordinate system? Everyone has seen this before, right? So say I have this coordinate system, and maybe I have a bunch of objects in this virtual world. I'm going to model them with triangles for now. And they might be defined in their own local coordinate system. And I'll probably have a bunch of different objects, all in different coordinate systems, right? And then maybe I'll put some lights in the scene, just like we have lights in this room. And I'll assign materials to these triangles, you know, just like this is wood or fake wood, you know, this is cheap tile, that's paint, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I'll assign materials to these. And then I'll insert a camera. And that camera has a field of view, and it has a viewing distance and so on. And now in graphics, at least in rendering, I'm interested in viewing this world from the eye of the camera. I'm actually taking this 3D world and creating a 2D representation of it. So way over here, maybe I have a 2D grid of pixels, right? So think of your screen. For now, I'll call this the frame buffer. And this has some pretty high resolution. You know, what is it, 1920 by 1280? Does that sound like a common resolution nowadays? And then each of these pixels, you know, probably has an RGB or RGBA value, where we use this to make any kind of color. And these might be 8 bits each, or they might even be floating point values each if you're doing HDR. So what we care about is taking this virtual scene and coloring the frame buffer. Right, so what you guys remember from 460, what steps And I don't need all the details. Like, you don't need to get up here and derive the projection matrix. I really don't care about doing that. But what major steps are involved to go from that 3D world to this 2D screen? And we'll do a traditional rasterization model. We're not ray tracing. So what do we need to do? Yep.
Using the camera, you have to clip polygons that fall off outside the camera's range.
Right. So, and maybe I'll draw that right around here. So here's our screen. And we might have a polygon or a triangle that's out here. Maybe it's completely outside. That needs to go away. Maybe it's completely inside. That's fine. Or maybe it's on the edge, in which case then we need to just get rid of it. Then we need to clip it. And clipping actually turns out to be kind of non-trivial, because you can run into all sorts of crazy cases. Like look at this triangle. Oh, sorry. I don't run into the chalkboard. Right, you got to clip that guy against the whole thing. So clipping is definitely one part of it. Okay. What else do I need to do? Right, so how do we even position if we have all these different objects and all these different coordinate systems? How do we even figure out what they look like from the point of view of the viewer? So we need to do a projection matrix. And this is all in the slide, so don't go crazy trying to take notes or anything. I mean, you certainly can take notes right now, but this is all coming up in the slides. Okay, so this projection matrix we can really use to define what's going to happen when we try to transform from 3D to 2D. Are we going to preserve parallel lines, or are we going to have foreshortening? Like, there's something called perspective foreshortening, where things farther away, they get smaller, basically. And then parallel lines, like a railroad, those lines will converge in the difference, in distance. And a lot of what we do, we're going to use a perspective projection matrix because it makes things look real, as opposed to orthographic, which you'll see in CAD applications a lot, where they really care about precise measurements. And I got some pictures for that. Okay, so we're going to have to do a projection matrix. We're going to do clipping. What else? Is this enough for us to render this 3D world? What else do I need to do? Yeah.
You have to also do depth testing.
Depth testing? So what does that mean?
So if you have two triangles that occupy the same space on the screen, you have to see which is closer to you.
Right. So over here, I'll say, put the depth tester down here. Yeah, so a big problem in rendering, which is one part of computer graphics, is finding visible surfaces. And there's a bunch of ways to find visible surfaces. But this depth test, which we'll go over, is probably the most popular way. And you just, depending on where the camera is, right, just look in this room, right? I can't see, I don't know what's behind this wall, right? Because the wall occludes whatever is behind it. But if I look out this window, the window does not occlude the building on the other side there. So as the camera moves, this depth test needs to be recomputed all the time as the viewer moves or as object moves in the scene. Okay, so this is a decent start, but we're still missing a lot of things. What else do you guys think we need?
Yeah,
I'm not going to tell Norm. This is how. So what else? I said we have materials and we have lights, right? Don't we have to actually have to color these things too? All right, so we need a whole set of shading. And we're going to spend a lot of time in this course looking at how we implement this shading and how the graphics architecture and the video part makes this really fast for us. Okay, so yeah, this is we'll build on this quite a bit in the next few minutes. But first, we'll step back and just look at maybe the bigger picture of graphics, and then we'll go through this whole pipeline, and at the end, I want to look kind of at the history of the graphics pipeline and commodity GPUs and consumer-level GPUs, and that will bring us up to exactly where we already are in this course, where we're already looking at like the NVIDIA G80, and we're going to see how we got there. I think this is going to take two lectures, but we'll see. I'm in no rush, so if it takes two lectures, that's completely fine. Okay, so this is the way that I break down the world of graphics. It might not be the way that everyone does, but I think it's pretty common to see this where, you know, computer graphics as a subfield of computer science, it's very cross-disciplinary, but for our purposes, I'll define it as a subfield of computer science. And in itself, it has at least three main subfields, which is modeling, rendering, and animation. And we'll look at each of them, whereas modeling, that's how do you represent your 3D world. So in general computer science, that's kind of like, what are your data structures? And then rendering is, how do you take that 3D world and display it as a 2D image? And that's kind of like your algorithm. You know, so I think of data structures and algorithms kind of like modeling and rendering. And then animation is how you create motion in your 3D world. How do you move the objects? How do you move the camera? I used to think for the longest time that computer graphics was just rendering. In fact, even when I was a student here, I thought computer graphics was rendering. When I was in computer animation, I'm like, man, this isn't computer graphics. This is math. I don't know what this is. But animation is definitely a huge field of computer graphics. This shows you how naive I was just a few years ago. And even motion, without a whole lot of fancy rendering, without a whole lot of visual effects, is still very compelling. Right, like even if you saw like your flocking simulations, right? We just rendered points, you know. But it's still, if you had a nice flocking, it was still really interesting to watch. Now, the field keeps getting deeper and deeper, right? So real-time rendering—that's the area of rendering where we can do things like interactive frame rates. Because you might look at rendering and you look at rendering in the movies, where frames can take hours, and they're okay with that. Oh, they always want it to be faster, but they can afford taking that time. Whereas in a game, a frame takes 17 milliseconds. That's what they strive for. So really, when we're looking at using the GPU, we're really looking for real-time rendering. Then there's even more subfields. Like, for example, a recent book came out on real-time shadows, where that would be a subfield of real-time rendering. So it's amazing like how big computer graphics is as a field. Okay, so just briefly, I know in 460 there's probably like two or three lectures on modeling, on how do you represent the objects in your 3D world. For the most part in this course, we're really just going to be concerned with rendering triangles. There's a million different representations that all have strengths and weaknesses, and I think as the GPU evolves, we're going to see more than just triangles. Right now, triangles, they pretty much dominate the real-time rendering world. But now that we're seeing more flexible rendering pipelines, I think we're going to see other representations become more and more popular. However, one thing that's kind of a sore point, at least with me, is polygons versus triangles. Like, you're going to see a lot of times people go, this model has 10,000 polygons, or this video card can render 30,000 polygons per second. Video cards do not work with polygons. They work with triangles. Why do you guys think that is? They're always planar. Adam said that's right. That's a valid answer. Go ahead.
Because it's difficult to determine like how large data-wise a polygon actually is. Whereas with a triangle, you always know that it can be represented with three triples.
Right. So definitely, absolutely. That's another reason. Right. So where's this chalk? So does everyone see that three triangles? That's 3 points. They're always going to lay on a plane. But if I have a fourth point. This is a horrible drawing, say they're on a plane. As soon as I add this fourth point, it may or may not be on the plane, especially depending on who you ask what the definition of a polygon is. Not to mention, a triangle, this thing is always convex. Whereas a polygon, that's still a valid polygon, it's no longer convex, right? And then, yes, you always having three triplets will make things really easy, especially when you have a fixed amount of memory somewhere. Maybe you have buffers in between stages in the pipeline. And then we're also going to have a process called rasterization, where we convert a triangle to pixels. And it is much easier to rasterize a triangle than it is to rasterize a polygon, especially an arbitrary polygon. In fact, so OpenGL, old school OpenGL, supported polygons, and in fact, I had a primitive called GL underscore polygon. I don't know if anyone's used it, but it would just naively tessellate, meaning that if you gave it a polygon, say I gave it that polygon, and it's like, well, hey, the video card actually wants triangles. So we'll say the driver, most likely the driver, we'll just do a triangle fan, and it's done, right? But if you gave it something like this, when it goes to do the triangle fan, it's going to give you the wrong triangle. Right? It's going to not even, it's not going to do this whole process of tessellation. This is something that the video card doesn't want to do. The driver should have no business doing it. I mean, in fact, GL polyons has now been deprecated, which is not part of like the core OpenGL set of primitives. And this idea of triangulating or tessellating a polygon into triangles, that's usually something that you do offline in like in a content pipeline. I don't know if anyone has worked in any game companies where I assume they have as many developers doing tools as they do actual engine work, and part of an offline pipeline would be to triangulate things. Also, let me ask you, what about storage for these triangle meshes? So say we have an object and we mount it with a bunch of triangles, right? How would you store these in memory? I'm going to give you a naive storage. I'm going to store P0, P1, P2, where each of these is an XYZ. P0, P1, P2. And let's see, my model has two triangles. P4. So this one I'm just going to store P0, P2, P4. So I just have an array of points. What do you guys think about my model format? Anyone's allowed to answer. You could wait a second, I guess, before. This is my model format. I'm going to GDC in a couple weeks, so I'm going to try to push this as a new standard format for all games. What do you guys think?
It's very memory inefficient.
Very memory inefficient. You guys aren't going to back me at GDC? No. Okay, so how would we make it more efficient? Come again?
Triangle strip.
Okay, so in this case, there's different primitives. What I'm talking triangles, individual triangles. But here, we could represent this with a triangle strip. And in general, a triangle strip is you start with three vertices. Then when you add a new vertex or a new point, it includes the previous two points, and so on. So if I'm doing a wall, you just keep adding one point to get one new triangle. So here, we only need four vertices instead of six. But I can't model everything with a triangle strip. Well, if it was like 1998, I could. What I would do is I'd model my model with regular triangles, and then I'd run it through NV Triangle Stripper, or any other triangle stripper, and that tool will run through and take your triangle soup and create a bunch of triangle strips, and with the goal of trying to minimize the number of total vertices. Okay, so definitely I could do that. What else can I do?
So you could store every single point just once instead of multiple times. And then you can have a separate, for drawing, you can have a separate array which merely lists the indices and points for each triangle.
Okay, so here I'm going to store every single guy just once. So here's four. I'm storing four of them.
Yeah, and then you could have some sort of thing perhaps called a index storage array or an index buffering object.
And tell me what the values would be here.
It would be 0, 1, 2, and then 0, 2, 4.
So can someone else tell me what these values are and why you picked them? Alright, so these are just indexes into this array, right? Like if this were straight up, you know, some database class, which I'm not qualified to teach, right? These are just indices. 0, 1, 2 is P0, P1, P2 is this triangle. 0, 2, oh, this isn't 4, sorry, this is 3. 0, 2, 3 is the second triangle, right? So now we only stored each vertex once. But we had to store this extra index list. The thing is, we're usually going to store this with unsigned shorts, which are 2 bytes, whereas these we're going to store with floats. So each one of these is 12 bytes, just for positions. And we're going to wind up storing a lot more than positions here. God bless you. And we're gonna talk a little bit more about this later, probably next week, when we actually talk about taking geometry, taking a big set of triangles and pushing them to the video card, which is the same thing as, you know, CUDA mem copy, right? When you're invoking your kernel and you're copying a bunch of data. But we care about how we're gonna store that data to the video card. We'll process it efficiently. Yes.
Oh, is this efficient? Because you have to read memory twice. First access the array, then second time get the partition.
Yeah, good question. Is this efficient? Right, so there's actually two types of caches on all but the most recent video cards, because I actually got rid of one of them. But there's actually very efficient caches for these that makes this. And you actually will organize these. That's another thing that you do offline, or potentially online. That's a whole other discussion. You organize these in such a way that their memory access is pretty coherent. So overall, yes, this turns out to be very good. This is by far the standard way that everyone will organize their triangle data for rendering. And if you're curious, I can tell you after class, or we probably won't cover it this semester, but there's ways that you can reorganize these. If you Google it, it was all over SIGGRAPH like a couple years ago. And here's just a picture, too, just so if you have trouble visualizing, you know, you can build anything out of triangles. although it's not the best representation for all, you know, like if you just look at a sphere, for example, you can build that out of a bunch of triangles, right? But as you zoom in and you get closer and closer to that sphere, the triangles just start flat, and you'd want to continue to tessellate it. So there's other representations for a sphere that you just want to keep it as an implicit surface and just treat it. You actually want to render that with ray tracing. But, oh, here we are, implicit surfaces. So here's an example. This is a really good chapter from GPU Gems 3 that's on using the geometry shader and other techniques for rendering procedural terrains. So here, this terrain is not rendered with a bunch of triangles, and instead it's rendered with a bunch of noise functions that have variant amplitude and frequency. And I'll actually give you another example of variant amplitude and frequency in a little bit when we look at vertex shaders. But here, there's not a ton of triangle data. There's really just some functions that are used to compute that are used to compute where the terrain is, and then they do something called marching cubes to create actual triangles, all on the GPU. So there's not like a million megabytes of triangles here. It's just some noise functions. Very cool. Procedural techniques in general, I think, are super important nowadays, especially because bandwidth is low. And also, when you look at like a distributed world, you know, you don't want to send a lot of data from machine to machine. So these procedural techniques are really cool. Okay, so that's modeling in a nutshell. You can probably have an entire semester on a modeling course, and there it is in 20 minutes. So rendering is what we talked about at the beginning of class on this board. That's given a scene, and I'm defining a scene as a bunch of objects made out of triangles, materials associated with those, the lights, or maybe just one light in the scene, and a camera. Given all that information, I want an image, right? And if it takes you a couple hours, I assume you're making movies. If it takes you 17 milliseconds, I assume that you're making video games. Or any. Actually, I don't make video games, and I do real-time rendering. So there's really two areas in rendering. One is the visible surfaces, which is what is in front of what from the given perspective of the camera. Right? And then the other is shading, which is the actual simulation of material and light. How do you get color? Now, finally, for the third subpart for graphics, animation, right? Move the camera, move the agents, re-render the scene. So this is something that maybe is not completely obvious, like when you look at graphics from the outside, but if the camera moves a little bit or an object moves, we re-render the entire scene. Right? Now, there is a lot of coherence from frame to frame. Like, so for example, we talked about clipping. Right? Well, say I have a camera, I'm a virtual camera, I'm looking this way. Right? Now, most of you guys are outside of my field of view. On the next frame, you guys are probably still outside of my field of view. So they call that frame-to-frame coherence, and you can take advantage of that coherence in time to optimize your rendering. But generally, when you really have an arbitrary 3D world, you re-render the entire scene every frame. Okay, so now, really for me, like the bulk of today, and probably even Wednesday, is I want to walk through this graphics pipeline. I want to walk through what we started talking about on the board and look at what a modern pipeline looks like. I'm not on the GPU yet. I'm just conceptually talking about something you guys can go home and program if you feel like programming in C++. However, I probably will start adding tidbits about the GPU, but only at the end of these slides where I really show you how this thing has been realized in hardware. Now, before we get started, for those of you that don't have graphics backgrounds, do you guys have any questions? I think that you can stay with us, you know, this entire talk, even through all the graphics in this course, but don't let me lose you. So are there any questions so far? Good. Okay. So for right now, the input to this pipeline is going to be all of our triangles, and we're going to break them up into vertices, and we're going to carefully define what is a vertex versus what is an attribute versus what is a component versus what is a point, because I think there's a lot of confusion there when you hear people talking to each other. But the triangles are made up of a bunch of vertices. We're going to push them through this pipeline, and at the end, we're going to get to the frame buffer, which for right now we think of as just the 2D screen, and we're going to get our image. And we're going to go through all these stages that we'll hit one at a time. Okay, so this initial stage called vertex assembly, this assembles the information for a vertex. So far, the only thing that we've said about a vertex is that it has a position. It has an X, Y, and Z position. But a vertex can have a lot more than just position. So to do lighting, I always care about how the surface is oriented relative to where the lights are. So for me to know how the surface is oriented, I need to store normals. I need to store vectors that tell me that are perpendicular to the surface. So here's a triangle. I need to know the normal. And depending on where the light source is, that's going to impact how this is ultimately colored. Now, the thing is, we can't store, not yet, maybe one day, we can't store normals per triangle. You really have to store data per vertex. So what happens is, you usually, if you have two different triangles that are connected and they have different normals, usually we'll end up averaging these normals and storing them per vertex. And this actually gets really messy because depending on the incident, so basically when you look at any given vertex, you have to average the normal for every incident triangle. But then, if the triangles, if they make really sharp, like 90-degree turns, you might want to insert a new vertex so that now you can have two different vertices with two different normals there. Again, do that offline in your content pipeline. You know, like when you're loading a video game, it probably isn't doing this. But the main point to take away here is that if we were to look at the information that we're going to have for a vertex, we probably have, yes, the position, PX, PY, PZ. But we probably also have normals, MX, NY, NZ. What other kind of data is useful? Color? So sometimes, yes, I might store an explicit color in here. In fact, a lot of times, you know, like I work on globe applications, you know, and you're like, oh, I need directions from here to here, and they just want to draw a solid line. They don't need to shade it. They don't care about those lights in the scenes. They just want a red line from here to here. So in that case, yes, we certainly might store color, red, green, blue. These are probably floating point values. These are probably unsigned bytes. They could be floating point, but they're probably unsigned bytes. What else do you think is useful? Texture coordinates. So local 2D texture coordinates, usually U and V, that we can use to read images and slap images on our objects. A vertex can contain any kind of data that you want. You know, maybe we're doing some thermal stuff. I could have temperature per vertex. I could have any data that I have, anything that's in my problem domain. It used to be in OpenGL that they had predefined names. This is GL vert. This is GL position. This is GL normal. This is GL color. This is GL texture coordinate one. GL texture coordinate two. And then when you were doing, when you had arbitrary data to store, like for example temperature, you would say, okay, well that's really texture coordinate two. And then that's how you had to write your code. And in fact, I have some old code that was written like that. One of my coworkers is like, they're like, what are you doing with this texture coordinate? And I'm like, no, that's really the lower 32 bits of the position. And he's like, oh, and it made sense. But now in modern OpenGL, you name these whatever you want, and your code reads so much better because of it. So that's a very nice feature. So all of this information together, we call it a vertex. One of these, position, normal, color, texture coordinate, temperature, et cetera, we call that an attribute. And then part of an attribute, we call a component. So just like a single intrinsic value, right? Like a float. Like for a 2D texture coordinate, U and V, U is a component, V is a component. But those together are an attribute. Okay, so a vertex has one or more attributes, and each attribute is made up of one or more components. Good? So this stage here, so the stage that combines all this data, it's we're going to call it primitive assembly because OpenGL calls it primitive assembly. You'll see a bunch of other names. Sometimes I see it called primitive processing, which to me is kind of strange because it's not a primitive. It's one vertex. Well, primitive is like a triangle. Or you'll see it called IA, input assembler, in Direct3D. Although I think Direct3D has a lot of names that I don't like. But we're not going to bash Microsoft too much. So you might ask, well, what is this stage even doing? I got to assemble information for a vertex. Well, why don't we just store all this on disk and we load it? And then, I mean, what does this vertex assembly stage do? So the thing is, all of this data doesn't need to be stored in the same spot in memory. Okay, so this model format that we showed right here with index triangles, we could have one of these guys might not just be position, it might be the entire vertex, or I might have more than one array, where one array has positions, one array has normals, one array has texture coordinates, right? I could, or, you know, one array has positions and normals, and another array has colors. You can mix and match any way you want. OpenGL is really flexible like that. Why would I want to do that? No ideas?
Memory choice.
Memory, possibly, I can't say that. I have another, maybe more, even simpler idea. What if I have dynamic data, but the only thing that changes is, say, the positions, for example. So say the object is moving, right? But the normals in its local coordinate system aren't changing, or the temperature isn't changing. If I were to break out positions from the rest of the data, I could put the rest of the data on the video card and then only modify the positions and not have to string that. So OpenGL is really flexible in that your vertex can be assembled from multiple buffers. And I think after spring break, we're going to talk about that in more detail. And we're also going to talk about the most efficient ways to get this data from your CPU, from system memory, into video memory. And there's a lot of interesting things going on there in terms of synchronization with what's going on in the driver. So here's an example where I have three different arrays, one for positions, one for texture coordinates, and then one for these other normals, or one for normal, binormal, and bitangent. What does anyone know what's normal, binormal, bitangent? What are those? Okay, we know what a normal is. Man, this board's a mess. So we know what a normal is. What about these other guys? All right, here's my surface. Here's a vertex. I got a normal. Binormal, what's it sound like? Has anyone done bump mapping, normal mapping? So sometimes I might want to make a local coordinate system right at a vertex or right at a fragment. And so I'll have, I need three vertices to do that. I need a normal, a binormal, and a bitangent, BT I'll call it. And now I have three vertices, they're orthonormal, and now I have a local coordinate system, and I can do local effects in this coordinate system. And I don't even need to store all three of these guys, because if I have two of them, I could do a cross product, and I could compute the third. And that might be a better trade-off to save memory, and that cross product is probably very fast. So I have all these different types of data. I have them all in different in different buffers. Vertex assembly will pull them into one vertex for us to operate on. So here's vertex 0, where I'm taking one position, one texture coordinate, and then the normal, binormal, bitangent, which, by the way, we say they're interleaved in that buffer. And now I'll take vertex 1 and so on. And there's actually no indices in this case. I'm not showing any indices. I'm just blasting right through one at a time. So vertex assembly. Take data from one or more buffers, assemble it into the one vertex. It can be trivial if everything is in the same buffer. Cool? Okay, so now we're going to enter a stage called vertex shading. This is also called TNL, transform and lighting, depending on what year it is. But it's past 2002, so we're going to call it vertex shading. This is the stage where we're going to take our coordinates for that vertex, that are in model coordinates, and we're going to transform them into something called clip coordinates. And part of that will be the projection matrix that we've talked about. And anything else that we need to do per vertex, we're going to compute here. And that most commonly is going to be some type of animation, some type of motion. This was previously called TNL, transform and lighting, because they used to actually do lighting here. They would compute lighting per vertex and then interpolate it. And it turns out to have very bad visual quality. And we'll look at some images. Right, so for a vertex shader, a vertex comes in, a modified vertex comes out, and at the least, that means a position in model coordinates, in a local coordinate system, comes out and is in clip coordinates. And I'll show you what clip coordinates is. And this matrix that we're going to use to do this transformation is called the model view projection matrix. You will not have to derive these matrices. You may have had to do that in 460, and definitely a model and view matrix, I'm sure, in 462. You got at least a model matrix you guys probably beat to death. I'm just going to show you guys conceptually. I'm just going to conceptually refresh them for you. In your homework assignments, I will provide you matrices. Like, if you need to do something, say you need to do something in tangent space, I'll give you a matrix or a function that will get you into that space and out of that space. Okay. So we go through a series of transformations to get from model coordinates, from this local coordinate system, into clip coordinates. First, we need to go to... Actually, I think I have pictures of these. Okay. And these matrices, by the way, they're going to come into the vertex shader as what I'll call uniforms, because they're uniform over primitive. So for a primitive, like a triangle, each vertex is different. But the matrix that we're going to use to transform it probably is not different. All right, so we call these values uniforms. You can almost think of it as like the vertex shader, say the vertex shader is a function, and you're calling the function each with a different set of vertices as input. You know, these might be like member variables in that class, or they might be like globals, God forbid, I don't like that term, globals, but you can kind of think of them as globals. And although I am using some OpenGL terminology right now, I'm hoping this will make it easier when we actually look at the actual GLSL and actual OpenGL for programming this. But don't feel like that you should know how to program this right now. Really, I just care about you conceptually knowing how to walk through this pipeline. Okay, so the model transformation will take something from this local coordinate system, which is called model coordinates, into the world coordinates. Okay, so you'll have one world coordinate system, but you might have many different local coordinate systems, and each one will have a different model matrix to do the translation. This picture make a new picture, but this is the best one I could find, and this is from the Direct3D documentation, although you'll see I don't have too much on Direct3D in here. But we transform into world coordinates, and then we'll transform into eye coordinates with a view matrix. Okay, now when we're in eye coordinates, the viewer's at the center of the world, and it's looking down, depending on who you ask or what API you're looking down, negative Z. Okay, so we've translated it. We've transformed everything at this point so that we're centered around the viewer. Viewer's at the origin, looking down negative Z. Okay, and these are all a combination of, these matrices are made up of rotation, translation, and scales. Okay, now we go through the perspective projection, or we go through a projection matrix, and that's either going to be perspective or orthographic. And in most cases in this class, it's going to be perspective. And like I say, the perspective, that will give you the idea of foreshortening, where things get smaller as they're farther away from you, and parallel lines will converge in distance. This gives it the 3D feel, right, as you can kind of see on the right-hand side here. Whereas an orthographic matrix, this thing, it will still look square. Parallel lines will be preserved, as you can see here on the left-hand side. So the vertex shader does these transformations, which are just matrix multiplies. What do you think the dimensions of the matrix are? 3 by 3? Do I hear that? 4 by 4. Right, so all of these matrices are 4 by 4 because they can do translation. They're not just rotation and scale. They do translation. I should probably go over that quickly just so you guys, just so it's very obvious for you. Alright. So here I'm going to draw vectors in 4D. One has a 1 as a W component, and one has a 0. Which one is a vector? Which one is a matrix? Oh, sorry. Which one is a point? Which one is a vector? The one with 1 is the point. Right, so the convention, they call this homogeneous coordinates, and the convention here is that the 1 represents a point, and the 0 represents a vector. Oh, sorry, the 1, oh man, 1 is point, and 0 is vector, right? So you can add two vectors together, right? And vectors are just arrows, you can put them head to tail, and you can add them. But you can't add two points, because in homogeneous coordinates, you can only have 0 and 1. So if you were to do 1 plus 1, if you were to add two of these, you'd get 2, and that's not valid. But you can subtract two points, 1 minus 1, and you'll get a vector. Or you can add a vector to a point, and you'll get a new point. You'll displace that point. Now, when you have a 4 by 4 matrix, when you have a 1 over here, you wind up having, you can put a translation in the last column of the matrix. When you have a 0, you're just going to, that multiplication of this vector times this matrix, you're going to get zeros right here because you can't translate the vector, right? A vector doesn't have a location in 3D world, it's just a direction. So this is why there are 4 by 4 matrices, because they have translation in them for points. Is that clear? It should become pretty clear too, like when you're in your shader, and you'll see if you're using vec3 or vec4. Okay, so one thing that I want to point out here is these matrices, the model, view, and projection matrices, you can multiply them all together and get the model, view, projection, or sometimes you'll see MVP matrix. It's not most valuable player, and I just realized that it could be looked at like that. You can burn them into one matrix and just use that matrix. Okay, so as long as all the vertices are in the same model coordinates, you can use the same model view projection matrix. Assuming for some reason the view and projection matrices don't change, but they probably won't change. Usually, just the model will change often. So what are the advantages of doing this? Yep.
I mean, in the shader, you don't want to have to do 3 matrix multiplies each vertex.
Right.
Just have one
matrix. Yeah, exactly. So if you did this multiplication up one, you know, once, gave it to the vertex shader. Now every vertex coming through that shader uses that one matrix. It's just, you know, you just pre-computed it, right? So that's good. What about a drawback? When might we not want to do this?
You could
Come again?
You can unchange the individual matrix.
Right, so yeah, we were to change an individual matrix, we'd have to recompute that. But if we're not using the individual matrices, then we're not going to be able to work in this coordinate system. So for example, if I said, okay, write me some code such that, what do I want to do? Let's fade out the object as it gets farther away from me. So maybe a really easy way to do that is you go into I coordinates where you know the z value. As the z value, the absolute value of the z value gets bigger and bigger, that is farther away, right? So in that case, you might want to work in I coordinates, you know. Or when you look at lighting, because those lights are in some coordinate, the lights are in some coordinate system themselves, you're going to need a common coordinate system to do lighting, where the object and the lights are in the same light coordinate. That's usually or in the same coordinate system. That's usually I coordinates. So sometimes we can burn together this whole matrix and we use it just like that. Sometimes we have subsets of the other matrices, because you can multiply any of those. Like you could have the model view matrix to get into I coordinates, or just the model coordinate to work in work coordinates. So typically when you see uniforms coming into a vertex shader, you'll probably see several of these. These used to be built into OpenGL. It used to tell OpenGL, here's my model matrix, here's my view matrix, and then it would make your model view matrix, or here's my projection. It would make model view projection. That is no longer the reality. That's a deprecated feature. Now you have to make your own matrices, and you provide them to the vertex shader. In fact, OpenGL even had features like where it would do your translations, your rotations, your scales. These really simple matrix operations. Now, has anyone ever used them? Like GL translate, GL rotate. No, one? Okay. So a few of you. So those actually have been deprecated. And the reason they've deprecated that is because there's really the graphics API has no business exposing features like that, because it's not going to accelerate those. Like if you say GL translate 5, it's not going to go to the video card and do this translation and then come back and give it to you. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't need to accelerate it. Since probably about 2008, OpenGL has really trimmed down the API and got rid of kind of a lot of the bloat that has came over the past 20 years. And now it's a pretty lean API that really is tight to the hardware and exposes what the hardware can do and nothing more. Okay, so I want you guys to help me do this example for pulsing using a vertex shader. So here's an alien, right? We see him non-deformed on the left-hand side. But over time, we want him to pulse, where he kind of goes back and forth like this, you know, kind of in a wavy pattern. I promise you that we could implement this in a vertex shader. So not only do we always do our normal model view projection transformation, but I want to look at another example. And here, I'd call this would fall in the category of animation, where we're going to deform this model. Over time, you know, maybe it's a game and you just killed him, you're going to deform him, then you're going to fade him out, or anything like that. The one thing that I will give you to help you compute this is I'm going to give you a time that goes into that vertex shader. It's a uniform. It's the same for the entire model, right? That's probably thousands of triangles, or maybe, let's say this model is 5,000 triangles. I'm going to give you a time that goes in that's the same for all of these. And then as we keep repeating refreshing the page and redrawing the scene, we're going to update that time. I'm just going to increase that time, you know, time plus equals some delta. So how do you think that we could use that time to do this pulsing effect in the vertex shader? Yep.
The greater the time, the farther up the points can go.
Okay, so we're going to move each vertex time dependent, but if we just let the time keep increasing and we're not just going to keep scaling. At some point, sine, cosine. Okay, sine, very good. So sine of time. Okay, so tell me more. We have time coming in. We're going to do sine of time or cosine, either one, doesn't matter to me. And we're going to modify the point. Well, I mean, how are we going to modify the point, though? We need to move it somewhere along some direction. What direction do you think would be good?
Surface normal.
Right? I heard surface normal. So if each vertex has position and normal, and if we were to move each of those each position along its normal in a sinusoid or pattern based on the time, I'm pretty sure that we could get a pulsing effect like this. All right, so here's an example where here's 4 points and 4 normals. And if we do this displacement, and I was going to say, well, how do we do the displacement? You guys already got that. Sine function will definitely help us go up and down. All right, so here's an implementation. I take the sine of the time, and sine is usually -1 to 1. But I don't want to move it the opposite direction. I could, but for this case, I've scaled and biased it, so now the sine goes between 0 and 1. Okay, and you'll see this scale and bias like all the time in graphics to change the range. And now, given this displacement, you know, we'd say the position equals position plus displacement times normal. And the normal, we assume, is normalized, right, is of unit length. So this would work, but what, especially from an artist point of view, and the artist wants to tweak parameters, is this enough? Like, would this work for all models, for all scales? Like, what else do you think we might want to do here? Add randomness? Okay, we could. That's not the direction I want to go, but certainly we could add some randomness. We could replace that sine function with anything we want. Right, so this is displacing between 0 and 1. But I don't know what that means. That could be meters. That could be centimeters. You know, I have no idea, right? So we might want to scale this whole thing and provide a factor. And then an artist gets a little slider, and then they can see how it looks. And that's the amplitude, right, of the sine function. Or we might also want to change the frequency so that we have bulging more often or less often. And we could do that by multiplying by the time here. Right, so I just added a few new parameters here. The time. Oh, actually, I didn't even add that yet, did I? Oh, no, I did add it. There we go. Frequency, time. Frequency times the time, and the scale factor to change the whole pulsing here. What are we missing? Are we getting the individual bulges for each vertex? Are we going in and out? Or is the whole object going like this? The whole object is going in and out, right? Almost like he's breathing heavy. Like if you had a model and maybe you only put this on the chest, maybe at this point he's breathing heavy, right? But we care about pulsating the entire object, you know, up and down like this. That's my hint, actually. You know, here it is. Hint. He's going pulsing back and forth, right? Based on the y direction. That's an interesting idea. All right, so what if we, as part of the sine function we use, and we're in model coordinates now with this position, we base it on the y position, right? Now you're going to get a different value of the sine function all along the height for the model, assuming y is up. And you can base it on whatever you want. It could be on the x-direction. It could be in any coordinate system you want. You could do it in screen space. And that's it. So this is pretty cool. This is right. This is one line of code to compute the displacement. You only need one more line to actually displace the position. But it's one line of code to do a pretty cool effect, right? It's not very hard. This is the legitimate GLSL code, although I haven't introduced GLSL yet. But I feel that this code should read. I mean, that's probably valid C code too, as far as I can tell. You'll notice I put U_ under things that I think should be uniforms as a naming convention. And the position would be would be an attribute from the vertex. Okay? So we look at this, and the position varies every vertex. But a lot of these uniforms, of course, do not. So you can pre-compute these. For example, U scale factor times 0.5. You don't need to compute that per vertex in the vertex shader. You could compute that once and provide that. Same with frequency times time, U frequency times U time. You can multiply that, provide it to the vertex shader. Now, GLSL, the compiler, will probably do that for you, meaning that the compilers that own desktops have gotten pretty good, and if you were to write code like this, it would recognize, hey, look, these are really constant across all vertices, so I'm going to compile the shader and optimize that. Handhelds, probably as well for this simple optimization, but in general, the mobile platforms, the compilers, are not as good as they are on the desktop. And I believe that's because the mobile platform is not as fast as the desktop, so when, you know, when NVIDIA implements the GLSL compiler, they're not going to spend as much time optimizing because the compile time would be too long. It is, and I don't want to get too much off subject here, but interesting things can happen, or at least used to happen, definitely like in the 2008 era, where I would change a uniform value, you know, like I would say, you know, U time plus equals step, and suddenly my performance would go down. And that would be because the driver would say, hey, he changed this uniform, I bet I can optimize this shader, and it would recompile your shader. And so drivers, actually, they do have heuristics where they go, okay, you know, it's like cost-benefit analysis. If they change this uniform, should I recompile the shader or should I not? Because they're going to take me time to recompile the shader, but then the shader's going to run faster. And they used to not be that good, because I definitely had serious problems where like performance would just drop big time. Whereas now I don't notice it, or maybe I'm just not benchmarking as much as I used to. Okay, so not only can a vertex shader read these uniform values like time and these different matrices, but we can also give it textures, right? I'm just going to loosely define textures as 2D images. I mean, think Photoshop. Think that, you know, you took a picture with your camera and you want to plop that picture on a texture, or you want to plop that picture on an image. That process is called texture mapping, and that image is called a texture. Although I'm going to say we're dealing with 2D textures right now, 1D textures also exist, although I don't really know why, because most people, I think, just use 2D textures that are one a height of one. And there's also 3D textures that people use for volume rendering, which I'm sure you guys used when you did your volume render in 460. So vertex shaders can read from textures as well as uniforms. And in fact, a texture is almost passed in as a uniform. We'll look at those exact details. But this is useful for us because we can do something called displacement mapping, where on the left-hand side here, just look at the water, and it's relatively flat. And on the right-hand side, you see ripples, right? So the way that they're implementing this here is that although the water is pretty flat on the left-hand side, it's tessellated. It has a lot of triangles that are all planar. And then they pass in an image that is not really pixels, it's not RGB, it's just heights. It's a height map. So just think grayscale, luminance image. And then they read from that image to displace each vertex. Again, just like we were displacing each vertex with the pulsing, they'll displace each vertex for the wave pattern, right? And then you can imagine that you can just update that height map. So now you're not updating X, Y, Z vertices, you're just updating X vertices. Or even in the vertex shader itself, you can displace that height map too over time, right, to get weather effects. And this was a demo. This was a really big deal and the GeForce 6, which was 2004, where we could have vertex shaders that could read from textures. It was funny, though, because only certain formats, like your RGB texture had to be a floating point or unsigned byte, I forget what formats, but if you had a texture that wasn't one of the well-supported formats, your performance would just sink big time. Now, on GeForce 8 and newer, you can read any format in the vertex shader, and it's the same as reading it in the fragment shader, which we'll talk about. And we'll say a little bit more about why exactly that is. What else do I want to say about this? Yeah, that's probably it. So you'll see this called VTF sometimes, vertex texture fetch. And we'll also see a different way to do this displacement mapping, where we don't have to tessellate everything up front. Sean will do that in his student presentation with tessellation shaders. Okay, so I want to show you guys some demos for the vertex shaders. There's a few of them that I'm pretty excited about. And also, I think this one I'm about to show you is really simple. That it will make things crystal clear if they're not already. Okay, so CSS, right, Cascading Style Sheets, you guys have probably done some web work before. They're pushing to add a new standard called CSS shaders, which will bring these OpenGL style shaders to CSS, where just think of any element, think of an image on a website, and it will allow you to tessellate that image just planarly put triangles on top of it. Like here you see two triangles. Here we break it up into, you know, whatever, 10 by 10 triangles. And then run a vertex shader on that object. So we can do all different types of effects. They have some really cool examples over here. So let's watch them. I might have to refresh this page. 9 minutes remaining. Oh man, I don't think I plugged in this. All right, so here, this flipbook, that animation, that's all done in the vertex shader. And this will be in web pages. Right, so you'll go to CNN or you'll go wherever, and you can get effects like this. These are hardware accelerated. They're running on the GPU, all using GLSL, right? OpenGL style shaders that are available to the web programmer or to. And see, they even have videos in there. Geez, I wasn't watching. And look, you're even going to be able to edit things. Like, this is going to be wild. Now, here's one I want to implement myself. Or someone on my team will implement. Man. All right, I don't know why I have to keep refreshing this page. But this map unfolding, again, is pretty cool. And this is all just a vertex shader where it's moving each point over time. And you'll see here that they're able to dynamically change the image, right? And they just keep uploading it as a texture. That's all behind the scenes to the shader developer. So this is a pretty cool technology. CSS shaders, I believe Adobe is pushing it. And I think that I'm trying to find out if there's a public implementation. Does anyone know if there's a public implementation available or not? Because this, doing something with this would be a great student project, right? Because it's very cutting edge, and it's very new, and I think that there's a lot of interesting work that you could do here. And it's good to do that now. Like, say you're in industry, you take on risk. There's pluses and minuses, but like when you're an early adopter, you take on a lot of risk because the technology might not pan out, and there's potentially bugs and stuff that you have to deal with. Like, you know, I would say we were borderline early adopters for WebGL at my work, where we've been using it for about a year now. And, you know, there's definitely bugs and stuff in the implementation. But being an early adopter, at least you get to go to market really early. But for you guys, you know, there's no worries here, like about, you know, your whole product disappearing, unless you're trying to build a startup out of this course, which is, well, that'd be very cool with me. It's completely okay. But I think the CSS shaders, again, these would be awesome. Okay, the other demo I want to show you guys is a tool called RenderMonkey. Has anyone used RenderMonkey before? Okay, so RenderMonkey is made by AMD, or ATI, and AMD bought ATI. It's a shader editor, so you can think of like a full-blown model editing tool like Maya, 3D Studio Max. This tool is really just for editing shaders and, you know, applying materials to, or applying textures to them. It's pretty nice. My friend uses it a lot at work, at our work. He's even asked them, so the bad news here is that AMD is not supporting this, meaning they're not developing new versions of it. And we asked them if they would open source it, but he said that, my friend said, at least as of right now, they're not going to open source it. But it has a number of really cool examples. So you can just Google RenderMonkey, you can download it, and you can see there's a million examples. But this bouncing ball here, this is done in a vertex shader, where we can move the position of the ball over time. And then the ground is also, it's tessellated, and then over time it's moving based on like a sine function where it caves in and caves back up. And these are only a few lines of code. Like, we don't need to go over the code, but like, here's the code for moving that ball. Okay, so a lot of this is figuring out how much to displace the ball. The ball is just moving in one direction, right? A lot of this is taking that time, doing some functions to figure out what the current height should be, and then here it is, offsetting that position. And then here you see we're multiplying this by the model view projection matrix. So getting the clip coordinates to output it. And you'll see that position was a 3D position, so now they're combining it into a 4D, so that we have that one to do the translation. This thing right here, GL _model projection matrix, this is what I told you that's deprecated. It's no longer this is no longer in OpenGL. So let's look at some of the other examples that I have in here. The morph one is pretty cool. I've been doing some morph-related stuff at work. Okay, so here you're going to see it's going to morph from a cube or beyond a cube back into a series of spheres. And again, this is in the vertex shader. One simple way to do object morphing is in the vertex shader, you can have both sets of positions, you know, your source object and your target object. And you can linearly interpolate or cubically, any type of interpolation that you want. Here, they're actually using, I think that it's already tessellated as a cube, and then they're, and then for them to do the target of the spheres, they just know the equation of a sphere and where the spheres would be, and they just map one vertex to the other and just interpolate it over time. It's very simple. Like, when you go ahead, you know, download this stuff, look at the code. It's like very low code. In general, when you write shaders that run on the video card, it's not a lot of code. They're becoming more complicated, but it's not like, you know, you didn't write this 5,000-line C++ code. You might have wrote a 10-line shader. A ton-line shader, you know, that's maybe a little small, but like 100 lines, probably okay. So, for example, I have this 2,300-line shader at work that does ray tracing constructive solid geometry. It is the longest shader I've ever seen in my life. And I sent it to some guys at Google to look at a bug. And I don't know where the bug is, so I'm not going to say it's definitely a Chrome, but it could be in the driver. I don't know where. And they're like, oh, my God, you know, this thing is huge. So generally, shaders are going to be pretty concise, you know, just a page of code or so. And then here's one other example I want to show you. So here, this fire, this is done with a particle system, right, where you have emitters coming out of the tip of the teapot, and eventually they're fading out, right? And that particle system is all done in the vertex shader, where they're moving each individual particle, each individual vertex in the vertex shader over time. And now maybe you can start to get the idea of how people started to take OpenGL and hack it up to do general computations, right? Because a particle system, that's like a borderline, you know, you can say that's a general computation, right? So now people start thinking, well, vertices don't actually define where triangles are, they define where some other object is that I'm interested in, like a particle system or a position for a satellite. And then they start hacking up OpenGL to do the things that we do today with CUDA. All right. So that's about all I have to say about Vertex Shader. Don't get too caught up in the little code snippets that I've shown you so far, but just conceptually, a Vertex Shader transforms positions to clip coordinates, and it can do animation. Okay, and you could, you know, it can do anything that you got to do per vertex. So, do you guys have any questions just conceptually with this stage of the pipeline? Cool. Okay. So we have 10 more minutes. So we'll definitely need, I think, all of Wednesday to get through the rest of these slides, and that's completely fine because I want to lay these foundations firmly, you know, so that I don't want to rush through them at all. Okay. So now is the stage of the pipeline that for the most part, you don't have to worry about when you're coding. But I want you to know that it's there. That's called primitive assembly. So I didn't say anything so far about working with entire triangles, right? We just said vertex assembly assembles a vertex from potentially different buffers, different sources. Vertex shader will transform those. But we don't have triangles right now. We just have individual vertices. But they were organized as such that, hey, every three vertices is a triangle, or every two vertices is a line, or a type of primitive. They were organized like that, and now the pipeline, in order for it to continue, it needs to assemble these primitives, so just say triangles. So, for example, here's three vertices coming into a vertex shader. Maybe it all ran one at a time, because we wrote this in C++ on the CPU without multi-threading. Now, at this point, we need to recognize that, hey, three vertices came through. Well, guess what? That's a triangle. So my stage of primitive assembly in PowerPoint is the drawing of those lines between those points. Okay. Now, things could happen differently, where you have all three vertices, And maybe, you know, maybe you were implementing this pipeline in CUDA. Great class project if you want to do that, by the way. So maybe all three of these vertices come through at all at the same time. And then we recognize those as a triangle, right? Or any combination of this serial and parallel execution. So primitive assembly, is, you know, you also see it called triangle setup. Did I write that down somewhere? Well, yeah, don't. You'll see it called triangle setup as well. And I'm not going to quiz you guys on, like, name three different names for primitive assembly. Like, I don't care about the naming that much. Okay, so now we have a primitive. We have a triangle. Now, there's a few stages that I didn't even put in the slides. They're important, and I want you to know that they're there, but you're typically not going to be changing them because, as of right now, the hardware doesn't let you change them. But after clip coordinates, you have to go through something called a perspective divide, which is basically divide by Z, even though I show it here as divide by W, but that W is actually the Z value. And this does the foreshortening. And it gets us into what's called normalized device coordinates, where we were seeing the whole world from the view of the camera. And the camera, its view, in fact, I didn't mention this, and I think it's important to mention it. I said that a camera, you know, it has some location in the world. I erased that picture. And it's looking some direction. Right? But I didn't say much about any of the other properties. So when we define a camera, it has a position and a direction. We'll say position and direction. But it also has a field of view, right? Like, if mine's a lens, how wide is my camera lens? And then it has an aspect ratio, because you can imagine that I have a field of view, usually actually done in the Y direction, and then my aspect ratio, the width to height, defines my field of view in the X direction, okay? So from that definition, you can imagine that I've drawn a pyramid. Okay, can everyone visualize like a pyramid coming out from the viewer? Now, it also happens that I have to define near and far planes. I mean, what is the closest thing can I see, and what is the farthest thing that I can see? So now, my view volume, what I can actually see, is just in that truncated pyramid called a frustum. And these near and far values, N and F, those are just scalar values that are just the distance along Z or along negative Z that the viewer can see. It's really a shame that we have to define these. Because, you know, you might even notice them. I don't think too many games have this, but you can imagine if you get too close to a character, or maybe like a wall, if you're playing like a first-person shooter, and suddenly it looks like the wall like cuts out or disappears, and you can like see through part of it, it's because it's getting clipped by the near plane. So you can't just say, okay, well, near plane is zero and far plane is a bazillion. A near plane of zero can't happen because you'd have to divide by zero in places. And it actually turns out that the ratio of far to near will affect the depth buffer, will affect how we determine visibility, and can result in all these different artifacts. And a typical good ratio for a 24-bit depth buffer is 1,000 to 1. So if you have a near of 1, you might have a far of 1,000. And if this near was 10, you might have a far of 10,000. I have an entire chapter in my virtual globe book on this, and how to deal with this. Because when I'm doing virtual globes, right, 7 meters, I might want to be able to see a meter or a half a meter out, but I need to be able to see all the way across the world, right? So I can't have a near-far ratio that's this small. So there's different techniques that you have to use to allow this extra viewing. But so one thing, the reason I bring this up, because it's fundamental to begin with, but when you look at this view volume, the frustum is made from this, the field of views, when you think of doing the perspective matrix and getting into normalized device coordinates, unfold that frustum so that all of these lines are parallel to each other. So, you know, you have this field of view, widen it out. And that's how you get that foreshortening effect, where the things up front look bigger. Now, once you're in normalized device coordinates, that frustum was turned into a cube, and it's a unit cube. So it's centered around the origin. And at that point, you have an X, a Y, and a Z. And then it's just a simple scale and bias to go from this unit cube normalized device coordinates into the window coordinates. And we have an X and a Y as a screen coordinate. And we also have a Z value, which is how far it was from the camera, that we'll use for it for something else. Now, this is, you know, like I said, you don't have to worry about deriving these matrices. These matrices I'll give to you. And I assume, like, in 460, there's probably, like, two or three classes that would derive all these and would walk through step by step. Okay. So, clipping, we already mentioned clipping, but now objects that are outside of the screen we need to get rid of, or if they overlap, we need to clip them, and that can involve creating new vertices. And if you don't clip them, like, your math is, like, the math is going to work out, crazy things will happen, where you'll get all these rendering artifacts. Okay, so now we're going to get to actual rasterization, and we're going to stop after rasterization here today. We only have a couple more minutes. So this whole pipeline is usually called a rasterization-based model, right? Because we're taking triangles and we're asking, what pixels do these cover? Where you look at other rendering techniques like ray tracing, and we say, here's a pixel. What triangles or what objects cover this pixel? It's kind of like the opposite question. Right, so rasterization gets a primitive, it gets a triangle from primitive assembly, and it figures out what pixels are covered by that particular triangle. So how would you guys implement this? Forget about hardware, just say I gave you some C code, and I gave you triangle coordinates in 2D, and a grid in 2D, and I said, figure out what pixels in that grid overlap that triangle. Everyone agrees that this is an easier question than what if I gave you an arbitrary polygon, right? Everyone agrees with that. Okay, so I'll give you the triangle, now what do you guys do? Okay, I'll give you a really bad algorithm. You could flood fill it. What if we have a triangle and we figure out a point inside the triangle, and then we recursively draw the boundary for the triangle, and then we recursively go out in every direction, and then we just keep going until we have the edge of the triangle. So you can recursively flood fill this thing, and this, you'll see this. In fact, this was in the 460 book. I read this years ago. In practice, this would be like America's. It's not very efficient, and I don't know enough about hardware, but I assume this would be very hard to do in hardware. Okay, so how else would you guys rasterize the triangle? So what about a scan line? Years ago, before I took 460, I'm pretty sure they had to implement a scan line rasterizer, where here's your triangle, here's your grid of pixels, and we'll walk from left to right and say, not triangle, inside triangle, not in, so on and so forth. Now, what does it mean for it to be inside or outside a triangle? That's probably three lectures. No, we are doing a student presentation on what's called anti-aliasing. Because you can wind up with very jaggy edges, like in my PowerPoint slide up there, where you see where, like, this part of the triangle, is this pixel covered? Or is it not covered? You know, what percentage cover is it? You change the color based on it. Or do you have random samples inside here? You know how many of those samples are covered? There's a lot. Aliasing and anti-aliasing is like a huge topic. Okay, so we are out of time, and I'll see you guys on Wednesday. We'll continue this.